and he is third on the list of career wins by a manager. And he's just 126 wins shy of being in second place. In his 15 seasons with the Cardinals, he has brought 8 Central Division pennants, 2 National League pennants, and 1 World Series championship. Now, as many of you know, I am the self-appointed chair of the Tony La Russa Fan Club. I know it's not too big of a secret, but not only because of his success with the Cardinals, but because of his respect and appreciation of the long and storied tradition with the Cardinal organization. Each and every game, he has the passion and the fire in his belly to win that game. And when the ball doesn't always bounce his way, you know he's disappointed, because that is how much the game means to him. He truly cares. Ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm Rotary welcome to a future Hall of Famer, Tony La Russa.
I have a happy dollar because I know that the Justice Mary is an avid Cardinal fan, and apparently she's forgiven me because I had a message from her after we were eliminated last year. It was something along the lines, did the Gamblers get to you or something? She hasn't called or spoken all winter long, and then finally I think she's probably turned the page and give us another chance in 2011. So I'm happy, Judge, that that you haven't carried that grudge over in 2011. Yeah. I'll, it never fails to make an impression on me. I played for 16 years. I mean, it was mostly poorly done, but I played a long time, and not in big league cities, but in minor league cities. At the beginning of every season, they would introduce the team at a luncheon. It could be Chamber of Commerce, could be a Rotary, it could be something. And here's a lunch. And I never go to a lunch where I don't think about those minor league days. So I wanted to tell you a quick story about my first job as a manager. 1978, the White Sox gave me an opportunity to manage the Double-A team in Knoxville, Tennessee. Now, at that time, our farm director was a great old-timer. And for those of you baseball fans who have been around a while, pay attention. The name Paul Richards, you may remember. I mean, he's called the Wizard of Waxahachie, Texas. Paul played in those days when the catchers kind of stood up and had a round glove, you know, and barely had a mask on. And he went from catching to, that was in the dead ball era. Then he was a general manager, a manager. And he was in his 70s when, towards the end of his career, he was a farm director. And I showed up there as a young manager, you know, anxious to, you know, I've always loved the game. And I was one of the young managers in the White Sox system, so all spring long, you know, Paul is just drilling us with these lessons and these strategies about how to take care of things and all the things that we were going to have to decide upon. And obviously, if you watch the game, a lot of your important decisions as a manager is what you do with your pitching staff. Well, he starts out at this Chamber of Commerce luncheon, and Paul stands up, and he's got the team here, and I'm sitting there, and he goes through our team, and he introduces to the people out there. And he's got this Texas drawl, you know, and goes to each and every player. We had a really good team. As it turned out, one of the best teams I ever managed, think about it. And I'm serious. If you know the minor leagues, we had 23 guys. 14 of the 23 played in major leagues, which is unheard of. So Paul goes through this, and he's really bragging on me. He says, well, you folks are probably wondering. I've been bragging on these boys and probably wondering about who's going to manage this group of guys. And we've got a young manager here, first time he's ever managed. And if you're worried, well, I can tell you, if you've heard that the worst players make the best manager, this young man's got a chance to get out of that. So I thought to myself, you know, I know he just took a shot at my career, but I mean, I was always more a suspect than a prospect. But Well, that night, first game managing, boy, and I'm working hard, you know, paying attention. You know, probably that's where I learned where you don't smile during a game. You know, I get, by, as a PSA, that probably one of the most unfair questions, why don't you smile more during the game? You know, I just watched the NFL playoff games. I did not see those coaches smiling once. I look in the other dugout, nobody smiled. You have no crystal ball that's going to tell you how it's going to go. If you told me right now at any day, hey, I know you will win, I mean, I'll be whistling and smiling the whole time. But you don't, so you're there kind of grinding like that first game. And I'm really, you know, you're inexperienced and you're trying to remember everything you've been taught and you're watching, and it's got late in the game. It's a close game. Sure enough, we have a one-run lead going to the eighth inning. And I'm really working, you know, what did Paul say? Because Paul would always teach, the managers are successful, they anticipate the damage before it happens. Make your move before it happens. So the guy finishes the eighth inning, and you know, I had a little doubt about where to send him out for the ninth. And I wasn't really sure. I said, well, I'm going to give a hitter in the ninth, see what happens. But I started to look at that fastball kind of top of the zone, had a little hop. I didn't see it hopping as much. And that breaking ball had been snapping, was kind of rolling. So the first hitter gets up there, and there's an error. And you can never tell from an error. I thought, if one guy gets on, he doesn't look good, I'm going to bang him. Well, guy makes an error. Ball's hit hard. Next guy hits a double. It's a double. So second and third, and I'm going to get him. Because that ball that was hopping was now just kind of laying up there, hit me, breaking ball. And that's what I saw. That's the basis of my decision. So I go out there and bring in the reliever. He makes two pitches, base hit, we lose. Now I'm despondent. I'm sitting in that dugout. Now I know we got a good team. We got 139 games to play. But I was really concerned about the quality of my decision. So I'm sitting in that little clubhouse, you know, in the double A was about the size of that table, and sitting out this, and you know, kind of head down, and old Paul walks in, and I'm thinking, says, did Paul see what I saw? You know, would he have made the same move? What did he think about the move that I made? He says, boy, I said, yes, sir, Mr. Richards, you may have been a better player than I thought you were. So this will be my 33rd year doing this stuff, and I followed the advice of great mentors over the years, like Sparky. I asked Sparky, you got any advice for me? He says, yeah, you rent, you don't buy. Security is not something that... But I'll tell you the other thing that Paul said. He told me, he says, you want to survive, they're paying you to take your best shot. If you get into this and your best shot's not good enough, then do something else for a living. But you will never, ever know if your best shot's good enough if you don't follow this one thing. He said, trust your gut, don't cover your butt. So when you watch a game, you know, a lot of times you know you shouldn't bunt. Say we're down a run the ninth inning, leadoff guy gets on, and the book says to bunt him over. And you say, well, this guy can't bunt. Or if you bunt, it opens up first base, and they're going to walk Albert, which isn't ever a good move. But you do it because the book said it and you think you're going to cover your butt. Well, the fact is that if you lose enough games, I don't care how much you try to protect yourself, you're going to lose. So he said, as long as you understand this reality about strategy and managing, if you make a move and it works, good decision. If it doesn't work, bad decision. And I know a lot of you out there, if you're fair, if I make a move and I bring in Franklin, when Carpenter's winning 4-1 in the ninth inning, and you bring in Franklin, he gives up three. What in the heck was LaRusso doing? It's like Mary, you know. But the gamblers get to him. So you learn to live with that thing. And it's a different way to make a living. You know, and what you do is you just rely on your best decision, and if you can look in the mirror afterwards. If it's not good enough, it's not good enough. But you always got to remember, the other side has a team. They have talent. They're trying to win, too. So it is a competition. So here we go into year 16 here, and for those of you that watched those first few years, you're probably surprised that I am, that I'm still here. But, you know, we won in 96, but then in 2000, things really started changing. They started bringing in Walt and the ownership. The ownership's been the same all the time. Wonderful owners. They started bringing in some high-quality types, Mike Matheny, Edgar Renteria, Daryl Kyle. You know, they traded for Jim Edmonds, and then Scott Rowland came over. I mean, it was just, it's been a really nice time to manage a club because you can't hardly make a bad decision. So we had 2010. Now, what I'd like to do is just briefly give you some comments. I know I've sat in the audience when there was somebody that I looked forward maybe to hear what we're going to say, and then he spoke for a long time, and it was like 2 minutes at the end for questions. He said, man, he was all over the place. He didn't talk about one thing I was interested in, and I want to try to avoid that, so we're going to leave a lot of time for questions. But one that might come up would be 2010. It was one of the weirdest second halves I've ever been around, and to this day, I can only think of one thing to explain it, and it's Tom Seaver mentioned it the other day to me. But if you remember this, you know, we had got to a really good start, then we started getting hit with injuries. You know, we lost Loesch, and we lost Penny, and so that's going to be a struggle. But we got in the second half, and we had that series with Cincinnati where we were so irritated, and we swept them. From then on, the rest of the second half, we never lost a series to a winning team, never. And we only split one four-game series in Atlanta. So we beat all the winning teams, including the world champion Giants, 2 out of 3. Well, we went through a period of 8 series against losing teams, and we lost 7 of them. And while it was happening, you know, I have great coaches. We were there. What the heck's going on? I have players. We talk about that. What the heck's going on? So Seaver told me, he said, you know, Seaver lives up in Northern California now, and I had lunch with him and got around him. He's the smartest pitcher I've ever been around. He's with the White Sox in 84, 85. Brilliant pitcher. And he said to me, you know, when I pitched, one of the things that I did, I never let the sixth, seventh, eighth hitters get a hit off me because I was better than they were, and they were not very good. So I really bared down because I knew I was going to have to face Aaron or Musial, those guys, and sometimes they get hits off you. But I never let those guys that weren't very good get anything off me. And I really think what happened, and we've got really good people, and we try not to take anything for granted. I think there's a real strong chance that last year the answer to that mystery is we lost some urgency against some of those clubs that weren't very good. We let the sixth, seventh hitter get hits. We let those bad clubs beat us. And I blame myself more than anybody because that's one of the things that the manager is supposed to do is create the urgency. So it wasn't a fun. We got to the last week of the season, but believe me, it was miserable. Because as we were at the writers' dinner last night, you look around, you had two guys that were MVP candidates, Albert and Matt. You had two pitchers that are Cy Young candidates, Adam and Chris. You had the rookie of the year, who's also the comeback player of the year. And then you had guys like Shue and those other guys that play hard every day. So, I mean, how can you lose with that team? Or so she says. But anyway, we got to turn the page, and I want to make a, because I know there's some fans here. My wife tells me that Cardinal fans, she reads all this stuff on blogs and the internet. I told her, why do you read that stuff? She says, you know, fans there are tired of this drama every year, at the end of the year, about whether you're coming back or not. They think that you're creating some kind of soap opera. I said, that's not right. So I've taken whenever I can an opportunity to explain this. So how many people here are fans of St. Louis Cardinals? All right. So I'm going to ask you so that you understand what I'm thinking. You know, sometimes you have ownerships, if you have a multi-year contract with a manager, whether it's football, basketball, baseball, and they're not sure. They probably, if they had a free hand, they'd dump them. But they're not 100% sure, and they owe them money. And they may not want to pay twice. They pay the guy that they're firing and bring in another guy. So sometimes the owner doesn't really want the guy, but too cheap to fire him. So one way you get around that is that I don't care what my contract is. Our understanding is that every year, no matter what the contract is, Bill DeWitt and the owners know if they don't want me, all I got to just tell them. Because that's a terrible place to be. Because you have to stay there. So as I'm a fan, I'd like to have the certainty that the manager at the end of the year is the one that the owners want. There isn't any other thing binding that manager of that club like owed money. All right? So that's test one. So I wait till the year until they offer me a job. Second thing you do is, suppose they want you and they've read the clubhouse wrong and you've lost the players. And you're supposed to be a leader. And I say, I'll tell you what, fellas, we're going to go out that door. And they go out that way. Well, a lot of times it's not real obvious whether you've lost or whether they stop listening to you. So what I do once I get the offer is I make sure I check with the players. Because I don't want to be, I mean, I'd be embarrassed to come into this club next year knowing that I really wasn't a leader that they needed. But I fooled the owners and I'm going to do it for money. So what I do after is I check with the players. And if they say, and you can tell, if I know that I've lost them, I tell thank you for the offer, but I can't take this job. I swear I would tell them that. I mean, that's just, so if I'm a fan, wouldn't you want the manager to have the support of the owner and the players? And the last one is, say you get that. The last one is you check yourself. And the test you say is, you know, are you really fired up to do it again? Now, I've been doing it a long time. And I mean, I'm not going to manage forever, but sometimes, especially when it ended like it did, you know, that stuff wears you out and you start thinking, well, this is not a lot of fun. And 15 years is a long time, 16, you know, people get tired of me. I know the media's tired of me. I'm tired of them. So I think to myself, I'm a fan, and they offered me a contract, and the players want you, but you know that fire's not in your gut. Would you really want a manager that's going to fake it out and just steal the money? So I'll wait and see if, you know, once I get those first two tests, and I check myself. And so I drove home, and I'm driving home, and you know, right away, that fire starts burning me. And then I said, I'm going to be selfish, and I said, I'll accept the job. So I try to explain to my wife. She says, I don't think the bloggers are going to buy that. I said, well, I can't help it, but I know more about the Midwestern folks than the bloggers do, evidently, because that's my explanation. And what I think you have is you have a manager that's very excited and motivated, as excited as I was when I was 1978, hopefully a little smarter and more experienced. The players and I have a nice relationship. I think the owner knows. I mean, if I'm the wrong manager, then they've made a mistake because they offered me the job. So that's the reason for the soap opera. So why did I take the job? And this is the last point about baseball, and then we get to the questions. Because there is something about the St. Louis Cardinals that if you're selfish and you get a chance to manage, you take that selfishly. I don't want to have the pleasure of putting that uniform on and being in the manager of this franchise. I've been raised by my parents, and I like to share it. I'm a pretty good person, but I'm not that good. That I want to, hey, you have this great opportunity. Charlie knows this as well as anybody. We were at the Writers' Journal last night, you know, and Lou Brock was talking about how he learned to steal bases from Jesse Owens, the track star. We talked to Bob Gibson, he played with the Harlem Globetrotters. You had Branch Rickey, who was part of the St. Louis Cardinals. Then you've got Bruce Sutter, who invented the forkball. And then, Fred Martin taught it to him, but he was the guy that really brought it into vogue. Then you got those two guys that are just precious. I mean, in a macho way, I'd kiss Stan and Red every day if they asked me to. But these two guys, you're around them, you know, and unfortunately, you know, Stan's having a tough time. You don't see him as much, but Red, oh my goodness. What he represents, you know, we lost George Kissel a few years ago. He's been in the organization 66 years. So what I'm telling you is there's a tradition with the St. Louis Cardinals that you feel. And one of the most beautiful things, and I mentioned it last night at the writers' dinner, because of the guys who were sitting there. The guys that play on our team, they know it. They really know it, and they want very badly to add to that history in 2011. So we'll probably talk about what we got, but I'm going to tell you that part of that decision was I'm really excited and about our team. I love the history, I love the support we get, and my fire is flaming to make amends and get us to October, which is what this franchise, the history, the support we get, that's what we deserve. So I will not be smiling in that dugout because I'm grinding till we get to that finish line. So if anybody got any questions, everything's off the record. I'll answer it honestly. See, if it's off the record, then you don't have to do that little dance. Yes, sir.
Tony, you mentioned sense of urgency last year, and that may have played a part in losing to those two teams. Do you think over the course of the offseason we've changed that in bringing Berkman and some of the others?
Well, first of all, there's no excuse for not having it last year. And I'll be honest because, I mean, we have great coaching staff, as you know. And we pay attention, and we know our guys. You know, that's one of the ways we coach is we really personalize our approach. You know, we don't sit in our offices and send out memos. I mean, we're watching. And at the All-Star break meeting, I said, fellas, in our division, in our league, the three clubs that have the best chance are the San Diego Padres, the Atlanta Braves, because they were very motivated to bring Bobby home a winner. The Padres, and I mentioned Cincinnati Reds. The Padres and the Reds, because they were winners for the first time. And those, and you played against them, you could see them. I said, we can't get spoiled by winning. So it was way back in the All-Star break, I had alerted them to that. You know, we've won, but that should make us want to win as much. Because the other teams were, I mean, they came out there and they're excited. Point I'm getting to is, we talked about it, and we got there, but we didn't get there every day all the time. And I'm not going to be here because that's not our style. The issues that we have with a couple, three players, you know, we're a family, and, you know, I don't call the paper. And, you know, like if your son or daughter is late, you don't call them and say, hey, embarrassed. I don't embarrass anybody. We do within the family and the clubhouse. We don't tolerate it. But it was not as great as it should have been. Still didn't excuse it. So then what we've done this winter with our priorities, we went for the guys that could help us. So you could be not a negative force, we wouldn't have taken them, but you could be a kind of a zero personality. But if you could pitch like Westbrook could pitch, or hit like Berkman could hit, or play like Terrio can play, we'd take you. But what we've gotten into, I talked to this Cleveland person after we signed Westbrook, and he was telling me, Westbrook, we really liked him, but he was kind of quiet when he was with us. But now that he's with us and we was 2 years, Westbrook is a real leader, and he's going to be there like, you know, Karp, Wainwright, you know, Franklin. We got strong leadership. So that was, we got the plus. With Lance, we knew Lance from going against him. We signed Lance because we wanted him to get a lot of hits. But it turns out that he's a real strong clubhouse presence, you know, and just a good character guy. Terrio, you know, we needed somebody. You know, I like Brendan Ryan a lot, but he's, you know, he's up and down. And, you know, in our game, it's tough to win. And that's why David Eckstein has been on two world champions. David is the same every day. He may not get to that play. You know, sometimes look to me like Brendan made a play behind the third base coaching box and threw the guy out. But that you could trust that David was going to be there every day. See, so Ryan Terrio is a consistent player, and as it turns out, he's one of those. Gutty, you know, he played for LSU, and he's. So the answer is that we've covered it both ways. We got a better team on paper, and I think every guy's going to add to our chemistry. Yes, sir.
You got a lot of interesting combinations in your batting lineup with all the horses you've got. If you had to pencil in your batting order today, what would it look like?
People have gotten them. I bet there's quite a few of you that have been very negative about me hitting the pitcher eighth. And part of that would be we haven't had a great ninth hitter, so I'm thinking about hitting Albert ninth. And then the next day I would be sitting in the stand somewhere. No, I think one of the reasons that one of our priorities, the two big priorities we had, we needed a starting pitcher that could compete. Because we have young guys like Lynn and P.J. Walters and Olivino that should not be forced to pitch until they're ready. So they should be developing in AAA. That was one. On the offensive side, you know, too many times last year we had to hit a guy fifth like Kobe, like Freese, who are really good prospects and are doing well, but they should be able to hide six or two or something. So we wanted a middle lineup guy. So right now, you know, I mean, Albert, you want to, you know, some people, and, you know, strategy is just opinion, by the way. If anybody here, believe me, there's nothing wrong with saying if I was a manager, I'd hit Albert fourth. I hit him third because that's my opinion. One thing is he hits in the first inning every game. So I, you know, probably will hit Albert third. And I'm a little superstitious. He's had the 10 best years in history, so I don't think I'm going to mess with that. So it was important to sign Holiday because you needed somebody behind. The way to get Albert in the game, I mean, he is so dangerous now. There's only two ways to get him in the game. And even still, they never say, here, Albert, you hit it. It's to protect him behind and put guys on base ahead. So Holiday was an important guy, and they still walked him some. But, you know, Holiday ended up really digging in and having his season. So, but we got to get deeper. So now with Berkman, if I made it out today, I probably would leave Holiday four and hit Berkman five. But that does what? That puts Freese or Kobe two and six. And, you know, our lineup just gets so much deeper. The PS to that, and this is just basic baseball. I know what you all know, and I know it. I'm just telling you, it's not missing it. Getting guys on base ahead of those big three. If we had on base percentage, if they couldn't run a lick, if they could just get on first base a lot, the one and two guys, set the table for those three guys, we'd score a lot of runs. So, who is? That's why I don't know. You know, Skip, 300 hitter last year. He dipped, but he came back. You know, Terrio's hit first or second for the, you know, when the Cubs won. Kobe, I've said it before, when you have a guy like Albert, it's so dangerous. The guy hits in front of him is in, like Ludwig. When Ludwig hit second, hit 390. Because you sit there, and about the time the ball, the count goes 2-1, the guy looks over, and there's Albert. And the guy says, here, I don't want to walk you. It's a great place to hit. Well, Kobe Rasp was hitting second, which he's done sometimes. You know, that could create a lot of problems. I don't want to throw the ball down the middle of Kobe because he's going to hit 20. You know what I mean? It's some good problems to have, man. I mean, I go to Vegas and bet us. I mean, I'll cover your bet if we lose. Yes, sir.
What's the biggest difference if they between the Yankees team
Well, I think there's only two differences. There are only two differences. One, the players don't have to suffer with some really bad conditions. You know, the Bush family did a great job of keeping that thing maintained. So the old Bush looked better than it was. Underneath, you know, you turn on the spigot and yellow stuff will come out. That's not encouraging you to brush your teeth now. And you take a shower and the stuff, instead of being yellow, it's kind of dirty brown, you know, and you know, I was cleaner before I took a shower. So it's nicer down there. Now it's state-of-the-art. It's wonderful. You ever get a chance to tour it, I mean, it's almost embarrassing wonderful. But one thing I love about it, you go down the hallway, and we have our flags. If you see a white flag, that's a National League champion flag. The red one are the world champion. So there's 10 of those. And it goes the whole wall, and you go down to, like, 1920, and the history part, see? Players walk through that all the time. I mean, for the fans, there's no doubt that it's very, very fan-friendly. But the important stuff is how it plays. So I think you might be interested in this. When they were designing it, and they asked, do you want to participate in the design? I said, no, I only have one comment. Don't let it play small. Now, I know Philadelphia has won with a bandbox, but it's a real dangerous way to try to win over time because you penalize pitchers, and pitchers are the ones that you want to be aggressive and confident. So I said, Old Bush played fair. Let's have it. So we have exactly the same dimensions. It plays the same. You can hit a homer if you hit it well, but you don't get anything cheap. So that's the only thing I asked. Just have it play fair. And other than that, the other people took care of making it beautiful. It wasn't anything to do with me. Way in the back, sir. Okay, I'll do the third base first, and that is David Freese is a winning player. I mean, this guy is one of those, he's got the eye of the tiger. I mean, this guy's one, if he's healthy, he will have the kind of year every year where he gets a lot of big hits, does not scare at all. And he's got that nice stroke from left center to right field where you hit for average and you handle a lot of different pitches. He'll be a better than average third baseman. He's got a nice, quick first step or two when he's healthy. Got a strong arm. Last year he was doing this, and the ball was fading into, and he almost hurt our first baseman. Okendo in 3 days got him to turn this way, like, you know, where he could. So David Freese would be terrific if he's healthy. So one of the big challenges is who protects when David, and that's, you know, Alan Craig is a good-looking hitter. He's got a knack for picking a big at-bat. But Alan Craig is not a good thrower. So we've got him on a program right now where we change his mechanics. But the other thing is, our pitchers do a band exercise that really strengthens them. Well, way back in the Oakland days, the trainer we had, Barry Weinberg, got a guy named Mike Bordick, who couldn't throw a ball from shortstop without looking like a rainbow. And he worked this thing. And there at the end of his career, and all the time with Baltimore, he strengthened his arm where the ball had to kind of carry. He replaced Cal Ripken. When David Eckstein came over, you know, David, great. I mean, you heard me say this. I know Bernie gets on me because he thinks I'm, you know, I'm President's fan club. And I said, well, I am. If somebody wants to be described as being tough, I say he's David Eckstein tough. He is a tough, tough guy. But his arm strength, you know, was not really great. And he started doing it. If you watched his last couple of years, the ball had a little better carry. So we're doing that now with Alan Craig. Long-winded answer is we need to find somebody to play third, because what we should do with David, they're telling me through the first 2 or 3 months of the season, is play him 2 out of every 3 games, because he's got a little arthritis in there. Make sure it gets good and strong. So right now, I hope it's Craig, because that would get Craig's bat in the lineup, give him something besides the outfield, because I worry. In the outfield, you got Bergman, Colby, and Lance. I mean, and Matt. How much playing time is going to be out there? The other guy is Dan Descalzo, that came up last year and did a nice job at third base. You know, Dirty Dan, they call him, because he sticks it in the nose in the dirt, and he plays. If we could find a veteran utility man that could protect at short and third, that'd be nice, but I'm not asking anymore because they've already spent enough money. The difference is, I was in the American League for 16 years, and Sparky, who is one of my most important mentors to a lot of people, not just me, always told me, as much as you love the game, before you retire, you go to the National League. And so at the end of the 95 season, had a couple of chances in the American League, and Walt called about the Cardinals. And pretty much because of Sparky's advice, I took, you know, I said, wait, I'm going to try that. And I was here for a month. And I love the game of baseball much better than the National League. You get that question if you're a commissioner for a day, what would you do? First thing I'd do, kick out the DH. Because you see things in the National League game. I mean, that's why some of those American League can't defend the bunt. In fact, one way to beat those guys is just bunt all the time, because they throw the ball all over the place. They don't practice it. Nobody ever bunts. But I love the National League game. The game forces you to use all your players, and you're real concerned with, which is one of the most beautiful parts of our game, when you're trying so hard to either make one run or stop one run, then you bring in all the pieces, not just the big glamorous things. But are we running out of time? You're standing up.
One short question. Yeah, we're
what does she do for a living? Did she do that to the manager of the Cardinals? Anyway. The American League, by the way, is really tough to manage in, because it's like warfare every night with that DH. 3.5 hours of slug, 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 and you sit there terrorized. You're going to give up a 3-run inning, a crooked number every inning. They come out of that league, the winner comes out very tough, and we have to fight to get tough. One last thing before the last question. Proposition B, for all you folks, know that I'm an animal rescuer. I'm not an animal writer. I'm an animal rescuer. Dogs and cats, They're wonderful, and we use them with our organization. We use them to help people. They rescue, they help therapy, provide companionship to seniors, people in hospitals, battered women, abused kids, education. They're wonderful. All Proposition B is, it's about unfair and terrible practices by puppy mills that don't give a crap about them, and all they're trying to do is just manufacture, kill the ones that they don't need. It's terrible. That's all it does. It has nothing to do with government walking in and telling farms what to do and don't let the scare tactics. So please, don't let that Proposition B get repealed. All right, last question. Who's got the last one? Yes, sir.
Which three American League teams are the Cardinals most likely to face in this year's World Series?
Well, in the Central, because of my friendship, one of my best friends, if you were at the Rise dinner last night, I hope it's the Detroit Tigers. I love Jim, and although the owner of the White Sox is a personal friend, but I don't like their manager at all. And he was a rookie of the year when I was a manager, but he talks way too much. So does Rex Ryan. In the East, I dislike Boston, and they're, you know, when they beat you, they go, I don't like the Yankees' money. You know, I think they win with class, but it's an unfair. They just print money. That's not fair. I don't like Toronto. You know, just because I buy American. So that kind of leaves Baltimore and Tampa Bay, and I'd probably pull for Baltimore because when I first started, they were the class. They had the history that we've had. So, and then what does that leave? The West. Well, I'm an Oakland A's. That's where the A's were started. So I would pull for the A's. And I think probably two of those three choices are not going to be who we play. So anyway, thank you. I hope we have a great year together. Thank you.
We're so fortunate to have Tony here. He's had a busy schedule in St. Louis, and he's wanting to get home, and he's nice enough to fly in today on what could have been a questionable weather day. So we're so, so fortunate he's here. And Tony does so much with animals to help people, as he just explained, that he puts service above self, just as we do in Rotary. And so, Tony, we'd like to make you an honorary member of the Rotary Club. And there's your hat. I mean, I know you've got to wear the Cardinal cap a lot, but if you ever have a little off time.
I wear it during the off-season.
Yeah. Maybe we can get a picture of you with the cap on.
Sure. This may be a little bit.
Is it too small for you? Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much.
There you go.